Hi, everybody. My name is Deshu, and I'm an alcoholic. If you didn't get that, it's like Day and Shu. And if you don't get that, just keep coming back. You will eventually. And thank you for asking me. I come out here. I'm one of the people that believe it's an honor to be asked to be able to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really believe asking to come and share my story is the greatest honor that you can get. I mean, that anybody has, because what we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is our story. And the only way I can relate and the way I can help somebody else is by sharing my story. And that's really all I got. All the stuff that I get from Alcoholics Anonymous and the gifts and this and that, none of that stuff matters. It's my story that I can share with you. So thank you very much for having me here. I have a sobriety date. I have a sponsor and I have a home group. My sobriety date is October 17th, 2002. I have a sponsor in my home group, the Midtown Group. It meets on Sunday nights at 7:30 down in Bethesda, Maryland. So if you're out that way, please stop by. 350, 400 of us get together on a Saturday night to celebrate sobriety. So it's a good time. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to tell you those three things. My sponsor, my home group, and my sobriety date. I didn't know how important they would be to me today. They're really the foundation upon which my recovery is built. I have a sponsor who guides me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and gives me an objective view of my life. As you'll hear, I had come up with some really good ideas. and when I share them with him, he gives me an objective view of maybe I shouldn't do some of them. My home group is a place I go where I'm accountable. I have a service position there every Sunday night, and I'm there almost every Sunday night. And when I walk in that room and somebody asks me how I'm doing, and if I'm lying, they'll know. And I was going through stuff back in, last couple months ago, and I was going in there and I was saying I'm fine, and people were like, no, you're not, what's going on? And that's a good feeling, and that's a great feeling. And I have a sobriety date that I can go back, and that's the date that my life changed. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous, people in Alcoholics Anonymous and we alcoholics are people that get blessed with being able to live two different lifetimes in the same life. And it's amazing, and they're 180 degrees different from each other. One is full of chaos and misery, and one is full of happiness and joy, if you do what's asked of you. And I think it's an amazing thing. I want to say this up front. If you don't get anything else from what I say today, I want you to know that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it immensely. I believe it's the greatest thing on the planet. What it does for people, what it does for people's families, what it's done for me and my family. I can't really express in words how much I love Alcoholics Anonymous and what it does. So I'm going to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I'm one of those people. I don't like people get up here and they say it, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I think that's not what it says. And I don't think those two, I and it, are interchangeable. The it is we all know what the it is. The it was drinking, and it was fun. It was fun with problems, and then it was a lot of problems. Because if we didn't have problems, we wouldn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous. None of us came in the door just because I said I just want to hang out here. If alcohol didn't become a problem, I wouldn't be here. So I'm going to try to describe more about what I was like and what happened, I'm like today. Alcoholism affected my life from a very young age. I was about 10 years old, and I woke up one morning, and it was late in the morning, or early in the morning, late at night, however you want to say it. I heard my mom crying, and I walked out to the kitchen. We were living in Minnesota at the time, and I walked out to the kitchen, and I walked in there, and I saw her with two police officers, and I asked her what was wrong, and she told me Daddy was dead, and my dad was an alcoholic and committed suicide that night. That doesn't make me an alcoholic. His alcoholism doesn't make me, doesn't make me an alcoholic, and growing up with one, without a dad doesn't make me an alcoholic. So shortly after that, we moved to Maryland to be closer to family, and there it was an awkward situation for me. We moved into a middle class white community, and I was a short, fat Indian kid with a single parent. Everybody else was like a white kid with two parents. They were wearing all polos and Izods, and I'm wearing like Garanimals and clothes from Kmart, and I didn't fit in. My mom did the best she could, but I didn't fit in. I was. You hear about that a lot in alcohol. Sometimes I'm just different from my fellows. I'll argue with you that I was. you're looking at the fourth grade picture and you can see what doesn't belong. And there's me right in the middle, you can tell. It was a horrible situation. I just felt uncomfortable. I didn't like who I was. I wanted to be somebody different for as far back as I can remember. I took my first drink when I was 15 years old. And it really wasn't, it wasn't a big deal. It was, we found a beer bottle in a park walking home from school. And my friends popped it open, and they stuck it out and said, here, drink it. And I never wanted to drink before that. You know, I didn't even think about drinking before that. But at that moment, whatever went on in my head said, if I don't drink, they're not going to like me. And I needed, and I got to tell you, I drank for two reasons, really. I drank for acceptance, and I drank for effect. You know, and if I didn't drink that, I figured that day, I figured that they wouldn't accept me. So I took a sip, and I drank it, and I took it in my mouth, and I spit it out. It was disgusting. It was a warm beer found in a park. You know what I mean? It was horrible, and it didn't do anything or anything like that. But the next week, I was at a keg party, and I remember having the red plastic cup, and I remember walking to the keg, and I remember drinking, and then I remember waking up the next day. And for 17 more years, I drank, you know. And for me personally, after reading our literature and reading the doctor's opinion, and I believe I suffer, what makes me an alcoholic is that I suffer from the allergy. You know, I have the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, which manifests itself in the phenomenon of craving. And for me, I believe that my allergy was triggered the day I took that sip of alcohol. You know, because I never wanted to drink before that. And I can't have an allergic reaction to something if I don't put it in my body or if I don't ingest it, you know. And it's not the kind of reaction. It's not hives. It's not a rash. It's the phenomenon of craving. And for 17 years, I wanted to drink. And anything that I did revolved around drinking, you know. And alcohol took me places that I never thought I'd go, to do things that I never thought I would do with people I really never thought I would be with, you know. But I love the effect. You know, the effect produced by alcohol was amazing for me because I didn't like who I was. I hated me. You know, I wanted to always be somebody different. I wanted to be taller, whiter, skinnier, sexier, more athletic. I mean, you name it, I wanted to be it as long as it wasn't me, you know. And when I drank, I was somebody else. I wasn't worried about what you thought of me. It leveled the playing field, really, is what, the best thing I can describe. Because it didn't matter who you were, like what job you had or who your parents were, you know, or all this stuff that I thought was important went away, and I could look you in the eye and be okay with who I was when I drank. And you know, and I loved everything about alcohol. It's like going out to the bar and having a martini in a suit or going, I mean, I could drink there, or I would, you know, get on my motorcycle and go to a dive bar and drink with those guys. You know, it didn't matter. I mean, there was just all this stuff. There was excitement about drinking. There was all this, you know, the sound of the glasses and the, and just all the glasses. I mean, the wine glasses, the martini glasses, the scotch glasses, you know, you had to have the whole set. And I just loved everything about it, you know. Really, I really loved it. And I loved the taste of most alcohol, you know, and if I didn't, I drank it until I acquired the taste. You know, I hear people come in here and say they didn't like the taste of alcohol, and I feel sorry for them. You know, I mean, why would you drink it if you didn't like the taste? But it is really because they love the effect produced by alcohol, you know, because it didn't matter if I could get away and stop being and stop living in here, you know. That's what I would drink. And that's why I love coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I come here to be with people like me, you know. First word and the first step is we. And you all know how I feel, you know. You know exactly how I feel. And when I'm going crazy and I can walk into a room of any Alcoholics Anonymous meeting anywhere and I can just get that sense of, you know, and just the sense of being okay. And this, my head just quiets down for a little while. You know, I mean, you guys know. I mean, I can't, if somebody at the grocery store asks me how I'm doing, the clerk asks me how I'm doing, I can't say I'm suicidal, I'm in my head, I'm less than that. You know, they won't. Here, I come here and I ask you guys ask me, and you guys, the first thing you guys say is, did you eat? You know, and so, I mean, you guys know what I'm thinking. And I'm accept. You know, it's like I said, it's like I always look for acceptance, and I don't need to do anything to be accepted here. I'm just, I can be who I am. That's my job, and that's all I need to be, you know. And if I'm not being who I am, and I'm not being that person, just to being okay with him, you guys will know, because, you know, you'll know that I'm BSing here, you know, and I can't stay here if I'm going to do that, if I'm going to try to put on some sort of image or some sort of facade, because there's no humility in that, and I've had to learn that the hard way, too, so, you know, during high school, I mean, I'm a product of the 80s, I think that contributes to my alcoholism, but I don't know if any of you guys remember the movie, I think it was Pretty in Pink. There was Molly Ringwald and this little guy who followed her around. He had weird clothes and just was a really annoying guy. That was me. I had poofy hair and a rat tail and a black leather tie, and I wore a sport coat to high school. You know, like, it was bad. And it was, and I got picked on. You know, I got picked on. I didn't have a whole lot of friends in high school, And so what I did is I ended up running around with a bunch of my mom's friends' kids, you know, a bunch of Indian kids down in the county I lived in Montgomery County down there. And we would have house parties on Friday and Saturday nights, and we would do a bunch of that stuff. And I became the guy who, I made fake IDs, you know, so I was the guy who got the alcohol. You know, I got the beer and the liquor for the guys, and then I got the 2-liter bottles of Bartles and James for the girls. And they liked me, and the guys hung out with me, so it was great. And I created a fellowship. I created a fellowship that I wanted, and they liked me, and I had a persona and an image that I loved, you know. And I hung out with the one Indian kid that did drugs, so we were the bad guys, and it was cool, and at least at the time I thought it was. So, you know, I had an awkward time in high school. I didn't get along with a lot of people, and you know, but what alcohol did for me is I mean, an example of how alcohol works for me is in my senior year of high school, my mom was giving me a present to go on a class trip or senior trip, and I signed up to go, and we're going to this foreign country, and I look at the list, and after the money's non-refundable, and I look at the list, and it's all these guys who are picking on me and giving me a hard time in school, and I mean, they're guys I went to junior high school with and all that, but you get to high school and everything changes, right? And I look at this list, and I am terrified. I mean, I am like, I'm going to a foreign country for 10 days, and I am going to get pummeled. You know, I'm going to get humiliated, and it's going to be the worst time of my life. And we get on the plane, and I sit right in between two of these jocks. and we take off, and the stewardess asks us if we want anything to drink. And we start ordering liquor. You know, international flight, I guess in the 80s, it didn't matter, whatever it was, they didn't care. And we started drinking. For the next 10 days, it was like none of this stuff in high school had ever happened. We were best friends. You know, the girls they brought, those guys, me, and we were, it was like none of that stuff ever happened. We were best friends. And I had a blast. You know, and alcohol did for me what I could never do for myself. I got to be with the people that I thought were cool. When I got to school on Monday morning, I went to my side of the parking lot like I thought I was supposed to, where the losers hang out, and they waved me over. They waved me over. My friend talks about those pinnacle moments in your drinking, when absolutely everything is absolutely perfect, you know? And that was one of those moments for me. It's like everything just aligned perfectly. And alcohol did that for me, you know? I could never do that for myself. They wouldn't even talk to me. But just because I was able to hang out and drink with these guys and do all the stuff and all the admissions were down and I became friends with them, you know? And it was great. And I chased those pinnacle moments, you know, for 17 years. I ended up graduating there, and I went to the University of Maryland. And when I was there, I was a small fish in a big pond. It was 35,000 students, and I had no clue, you know, terrified. Didn't know how to do anything. I'm first generation in this country. My mom didn't go to college, and I was a fish out of water. I had no idea what to do and where to be and how to do it. So I still hung out with these Indian kids in the student union, you know. And my drinking kind of, it didn't really take off, but it was the most important thing to me, you know. I didn't go to class a lot, and I would hang out and drink and just not really be responsible for anything in my life. And I started to become a really bad friend to these people, and I was a bad boyfriend. I was bad to other people's girlfriends and stuff, and they got sick of me, really, is what came down to. You know, I had a bad reputation, and people didn't want to be around me. I was fighting with people that were friends with my friends. You know, it was a small group of people, and I was getting into fights with people. And I'm a small guy, and I don't deserve to fight. I'm not a good fighter. So I ended up doing the next best alcoholic thing I could think of and joined a fraternity. You know, they got to be your friends. You pay them, and they give you free beer, right? So it was the best thing I could do at the time. So I joined this fraternity, And while I was pledging this fraternity, I was living off campus, and I drove home one night, and I drove drunk, and I drove drunk a lot, and I'm not saying that because I'm proud of it. I'm actually quite ashamed of it, and I think a lot of people. I went to a conference a couple weeks ago, and the guy was talking about people talking about drunk driving, and it really hit home because, you know, a lot of stuff we talk about drunk driving, we laugh. You know, and he said, you know, we don't know who's in the room and who might have lost somebody from drunk driving. And I don't think I was blessed because I didn't hurt anybody, or God likes me better because I didn't hurt anybody. I just think it's what it was. And I just feel compelled to say that. I don't know why, but, you know, sometimes drinking and driving really isn't a funny thing, you know. But I got home that night, and it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, and my mom called and said she wasn't feeling well, and she needed me to come home. And, And I said, I can't. You know, I just can't do it. I'm too drunk, and I couldn't do it. And a couple hours later, she called again, said she was throwing up. She needed me to come home. And I couldn't. No, I couldn't do it. 5 o'clock in the morning, she calls, and I couldn't lift my head off the pillow, you know. And I just couldn't get up. I couldn't do anything. It was like an alcohol coma. I was mumbling, and it was just, like, horrible. I couldn't. Next call I got was at 10 o'clock in the morning. And it was my uncle, and he had said my mom had had a heart attack. And I ended up going to the hospital about 1 o'clock that afternoon because I couldn't get out of bed. And our book talks about a feeling of incomprehensible demoralization. And it's not necessarily in this context, but I'll tell you, I know that feeling into my innermost core, you know. And it's that feeling of when you look somebody, when they're looking at you and they're just like, why? And they're like, how could you? You did it again. You promised, you know. And I know that feeling deep down inside. And I ended up hurting the people I love the most, really. I mean, I couldn't do it. I couldn't show up for the people that love me. I mean, my mom loved me. She's done everything for me ever since my dad passed away. You know, helped put me through school and all that stuff, and I couldn't show up. And I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took me a little while to figure out this part of the story. I went to see my mom, like, twice in the hospital. And I convinced myself at the time that it was because I couldn't deal with having to raise my sister, maybe have to raise my sister alone, or my mom dying and all this, the fear and all this stuff. And I convinced myself of that. And after doing some step work and kind of really talking about it, the real reason was because I was still pledging the fraternity. And I was so worried about these guys accepting me and letting me in and wanting to be part of them that I didn't go. And that's the kind of guilt and shame that I bring into Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's kind of the selfishness and self-centeredness that I was oblivious to when I got here. You know, I hurt the people I love the most when my alcoholism is running rampant. And I use the analogy of if you take a pencil and you draw a line on a piece of paper and you try to erase that line, it smudges. It doesn't completely go away. And you erase it some more and it smudges some more. But no matter what, that faint line will always be on that piece of paper, that faint resemblance of whatever that line was. And for me, that's like that line between right and wrong, you know. When my alcoholism takes hold, that line starts to smudge, and it starts to fade. And then it fades some more, and as I keep going, that line gets fainter and fainter. And the difference between right and wrong gets smaller and smaller. And then eventually, wrong becomes right. And right becomes wrong. And I'm doing stuff with people that are doing the same thing I'm doing. And I'm hanging out with them, and we're doing the same thing. And if we're all doing it, then how can it be wrong? And then the alcoholic life, like it talks about in our book, is the only one that I know. And that's what happened to me. And that's what's happened to me my whole drinking career. I became that guy in the fraternity who would, people would call no matter what. They knew I would go out. And I would go out no matter what. It didn't matter if I had school the next day, if I had work the next day, if I had a test. I would go out. And again, it came down to if I didn't go, I would miss something. I knew I was going to miss something if I didn't go out. And two, if I didn't go with you, you might not ever ask me again. I had such this deep thing of being accepted by people and just wanting to be part of something that it didn't matter, you know. And the consequences were worth it, you know. I ended up starting a business when I was in college. It's one that the federal government really doesn't like, selling things that they're opposed to. It's an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I'm a true alcoholic, and I understand their tradition. I'll just say that I use other substances to prolong and enhance my drinking, you know, and when I couldn't use alcohol, it replaced it for the moment. So at the time, I was following around the Grateful Dead. I had long hair. I mean, I had this whole, like, chameleon thing going on. I had long hair, so I wore it down with tie-dyes and Birkenstocks to hang out with my hippie friends. I slicked it back in a ponytail and put on silk shirts and went to the clubs downtown, like Fabio, and I went to, and then I was in my fraternity, so I wear a baseball hat backwards and put on my fraternity letters, you know, and I would go around and I would have all these different groups of friends and nobody would ever know how bad I was. And then nobody ever really had to know who I was, you know. I never had to tell anybody anything and nobody had to give me grief about the way I was drinking and the way I was living. So after graduation, Oh, I did get kicked out of school, too. For grades, because I didn't go to class. And I paid my fraternity dues while I was not in school, so I could go to the keg parties. Good alcoholic thinking, right? You gotta go drink. But that's the kind of person. It didn't matter the consequences, as long as I could go out and have a good time and drink. And at this time, I mean, my mom was, she lived 20 minutes away. I lived in College Park, and she lived in Rockville, and I wouldn't see her for months on end. And she would want me to go to Frederick to help meet my sister, who was at Penn State at the time, and try to go pick her up when she was getting rides and getting dropped off in Frederick from Penn State. They had this commuter thing, and I wouldn't go. I'd always tell her something, and was like, I just wouldn't show up. I ended up graduating. I ended up moving down into downtown D.C. All my friends had left. They went to California and Colorado, and I ended up living right in the middle of this bar district in D.C. And really, my only aspiration there was to my greatest aspiration there was to be able to walk down to the corner bar and order the usual and have the bartender know what I meant. That was like my dream, because that was all that was important. I mean, really, my job was important. Anything didn't matter. And I ended up getting a good, pretty decent job at a pretty well-known international organization downtown in downtown D.C., 8,000 people. I get lucky. There was a time where I had a cubicle. And when I would go, I'd go to work, and I'd stay up all night, and I would have this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde thing going on. I'd wear a suit and tie to work every day, and then I'd go out at night, and I'd deal drugs, you know? And I'd go to work the next day, and there were times, and I didn't realize how bad this was until just recently. I would get up, and I would go to work, and as long as I went to work, I thought I was okay, right? I didn't think I had a problem, as long as I showed up. Now, if I worked or not, it didn't matter. There were times where I would actually go, when I was working in the cubicle, I would go to the bathroom, I'd close the stall, and I would just go to sleep for like 15, 20 minutes. Never think it was a problem. When I got an office, my boss ended up on a floor below me. I would go in and do this hour's worth of work that was every morning I had to do to update these websites, and I would shut my door and go to sleep under my desk. And I didn't, I would never tell you that there was a problem. I'd tell you I was tired. I just wasn't feeling well. I wouldn't think that. I never thought that alcohol was an issue. Never crossed my mind that alcohol was an issue. So on March 28th of 2001, I woke up one of those mornings and I had that same feeling that I had all the time, the wake up, the morning, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, just not wanting to have to deal with life, just all those feelings, like, God, why is my life like this? What's going on? I can't take this anymore. And I ended up going to work, and I got a call from security, and they had asked me to come down and pick up a FedEx package. I had worked there for 5 years and never gotten a FedEx package. So I said, I thought about that, and then I realized, well, we have a mailroom. Why is security calling me to come pick up a FedEx package? So I intuitively knew that something might be wrong. So much so, I walked down. I had to walk to another building. I stopped, picked up a pack of cigarettes, smoked two, walked to the front door of that building, and right when I got outside, the DEA arrested me for a conspiracy to distribute MDMA, commonly known as ecstasy. I was charged with a conspiracy of 50,000 pills, facing a lot of federal jail time. At the time, my sister had transferred to GW University, and she lived about 15 blocks away from me. My mom was even closer than when I was living in College Park, and I wouldn't see my mom for months. My sister ended up telling me one day, when there was a huge argument that we were having while I was still drinking, that her friends never believed that she had a big brother because I supposedly lived in D.C., and they never saw me in 4 years. I didn't care about the people that I'm supposed to care about. When she needed something, I would always tell her I was too busy. I would make plans with my mom and my sister for Sunday afternoons, and I was so hungover or still awake from the weekend that I just couldn't go. So I got charged with this 50,000 pill conspiracy, and then I had to go tell my mom that her son was a drug dealer. Again, that feeling of incomprehensible demoralization. My mom looked me in the eye and just started saying that we've been through worse and we can get through this. Unconditional love for somebody that continually hurts her. I fought that case for a year and a half. In December of that year, I was at a party for Christmas. It was the day after Christmas, and I was driving home. I was in a situation I shouldn't have been in with a... I just put myself in a bad spot thinking I could change something and with an ex-girlfriend, and it was just a dumb idea. And I ended up getting pulled over a mile and a half from my house, and I got a DUI. So let me explain the situation to you in case you haven't figured this out. I could have gone to jail for the DUI while I was waiting to go to prison. Because I was on pretrial, I was out on my own recognizance. I could not tell you, and I would still not tell you, that alcohol was a problem in my life. I was just having a little bit of bad luck. and I lost my license for 30 days, and I just had some people pick me up. I know, I spend the night at their house, and that's what I would do. And during this time, I started a business with a friend of mine because I had to leave the job because they have an ethics committee that frowns upon drug dealers. So I started a business with a friend of mine thinking that it was the only thing that I was going to be able to do ever again. You know, I mean, nobody was going to hire a federal drug dealer, a convicted drug dealer, you know, so my best option was to start a business. We worked out of his apartment, and he had, on the fourth floor, we worked out of his apartment, and on the basement floor, there was a deli, right? So we would go to work. I'd go to his house on Monday morning. We'd work till about 4 o'clock. We'd go down and get a couple 12-packs. We would drink, and then we would go out. And then I would come home, pass out on his couch, and we would get up and wake up and do the same thing the next day. I mean, I wouldn't go home for 2 or 3 days at a time. And, we'd serve to get drinking at 4 o'clock after a hard day's work of not paying ourselves and really not doing very well. But we struggled through this business, and I fought this case. And during this time, my sister postponed her wedding 3 times. We tried to do trial. I could not show up for my sister's wedding. It wouldn't have gone over with my culture. My mom and my sister would have been adversely affected having to try to explain where I was and what happened. And a lot of people in the Indian community down there don't know anything about what's happened to me. And so she postponed her wedding 3 times, because the federal government kept changing the date of the case. And she ended up screaming at me one day, telling me I was the most selfish person she's ever met in her entire life. And I ended up being, when they sentenced me, the judge let me actually, by the grace of God, I think, he took the 2 guys before me in my conspiracy and put them in jail that day, and he let me stay out for my sister's wedding, and I don't know why. But on October 17th of 2002, I turned myself into the federal penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. I was in the federal prison boot camp program, and I got to tell you that it sucks. I went there and with this delusion that they were going to look at my folder and my packet and understand that I was college educated and I worked for this big, this law firm, and they were going to understand who I was. I'm here to tell you that the guards, when you're a drug dealer and you get convicted, will treat you like a drug dealer that got convicted. And that's what I was, and I had this delusion. It was this horrible program of getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, hard labor, exercise, marching, hard labor, marching, exercise, about 3 or 4 times a day. So what happened there is I ended up, I wish I could tell you that it was because I wanted to get sober and all this stuff, but what happened is on Friday nights, an elderly lady and an elderly man with an oxygen tank came into the federal penitentiary and brought us an AA meeting. Now, I volunteered for the AA meeting because every night after chow, we had to march for 2 hours. When I was in the AA meeting, I could sit down. So, I was just trying to get over, like, every other part of my life. So much so that I volunteered for Al-Anon on Thursday nights. So, I ended up going to these meetings. And I'll tell you, something was happening there. And I couldn't tell you, now I can understand it. But there was 180 guys in this boot camp, and there was 15 to 20 of us that were in these AA meetings. And nobody was serious. We were all there probably for the same reason. But we would still go around, and we would still share. We would share about what was going on in our lives, what was going back at home, and what was said in that meeting stayed in that meeting. It wasn't talked about out with the other 180 people, and we read the preamble and all this, we did all that stuff. And I'll tell you, I actually got elected chair. I realized this the other day, too. It was my first service position. I got elected chair of that meeting when I was locked up. But this lady came, and she would talk. And a lot of times, we didn't care what she was saying. And I know what it did for her, though. I really know her coming there and sharing her stuff today. I know what it did for her. But one day, I asked her, what makes you an alcoholic? She I said, when you get angry, what do you do when you get jealous? What do you do when you get envious? She goes, you slowly go out and commit suicide while that other person is even thinking about you. And I said, oh. I said, that's me. I drank at people all my life. You know, beating ourselves up with a cup of anger intended for somebody else. Like it talks about in the fourth step of the 12 and 12. It's exactly how I was. I, you know, my mom, my dad, my sister, my employer, my girlfriend, screw you, I'm going to go out, I'll show you, and I'm going to go out and get hammered and get, you know, do all these things. They're not thinking about me, you know. And I went back and I wrote my mom a letter and I told her I don't think I'm going to drink again. And I had met this guy who I believe God put in my life at the time. My experience with religion and God to this point was, in short, was this. I watched my mom pray every day. My mom's, both her parents died, both her sisters passed away. This is when she was younger. The two kids of theirs, the nephews that she raised, passed away. Her husband committed suicide. Her mother-in-law died of lung cancer and never even smoked a day in her life. My mom suffers from health conditions including rheumatoid arthritis, congestive heart failure, kidney failure, glaucoma. I mean, you name it, there's a list. And I watch this woman pray every single day. And this is what she suffers through. There can't be a God. To me, if that's the kind of God that there is, I want no part of it. You know what I mean? I want nothing to do with somebody that's gonna act or give to this person the way, you know, when somebody so devoutly prays to it. And I'll tell you, I got on my knees and I prayed before I had to plead guilty, and I had to plead guilty, so God didn't work, right? So that's my experience with God and with religion to that point. And I found that this man that was there, he had the Bible. And we were allowed to bring one book in, a piece. And my mom had given me this book on Hinduism. And we looked, and we started talking about the stuff. And for some reason, I was willing to listen. I have no idea why. I detested religion and God and everything to this point. And we compared what they said, and they said the same thing. Just in different ways. You know? And he gave me this card, where I have no idea where he got it from, about how to pray. And I started to pray. I prayed for my mom, and I prayed for my sister, and I prayed for this woman who I knew was getting a divorce at home, And I gotta tell you, we didn't get any outside contact. It was 15. I had a 15-minute phone call once a week. We had no newspaper, no radio, no nothing, and that was our contact. So, I mean, I prayed for these people, even though I wasn't talking to them. And I changed the Serenity Prayer, and I changed it to something about God grant me the strength to change my life, the wisdom, or the courage to do it. Excuse me, and the wisdom to know it's the right thing to do. And I started to pray that every day. And I got out of that, and I got out of there, and I ended up at a halfway house in Rockville, Maryland. And I didn't know what it was going to be like, and I didn't know. And I ended up talking to the counselor there. When I got there, they were admitting me, taking me in, and they're like, "Well, you got to go to 3 AA meetings a week." And I said, "No, I got it. I'm an alcoholic. I admit that. I know. I'm going to go to 1." And they said, "No, you're going to go to 3. You're going to go back to prison." I said, "Okay, I'll go to 3. That makes sense." And I started to go to meetings outside of being locked up. And the first meetings I went to, I got to tell you, I didn't relate. I heard these people talking about going to jail sober, sleeping in their cars sober, being homeless. And I walked out of there. I'm property of the federal government still, remind you. I am property of the federal government, walking back to a place where they're going to tell me where to eat, when I can sleep, when I can do other things, and I have to piss in a cup to prove to them, right? They're managing my life. My life is totally not being managed by me. And I'm judging those people that are sitting in that AA meeting that are going to go home. You know? And they're going to be happy. And I'm judging them, thinking that I'm better than. And that's what I bring to you in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is what you get. You know? I ended up, my business partner at the time that I started that business with had talked to a friend of ours who was, who they went to a bachelor party together and stuff, and he told him my situation. And the guy said, "Well, I got sober. Tell him to call me." So I called him up, and I asked him to temporarily sponsor me, not because I wanted a sponsor, but because I wanted a home pass. and he said, "Well, you know, I'll sponsor you." And he started telling me all these things to do and these meetings to go to. And I started going to some of these meetings. And I'll tell you, this guy, I ended up getting another sponsor. You know, and because I wasn't seeing this guy a lot, he came over and read the book with me a few times and did some things. And I ended up getting another sponsor, and I came to find out that this guy was drinking when he was temporarily sponsoring me. But he had been an Alcoholics Anonymous and knew enough to carry the message to me. That guy died last November from this disease. I'm eternally grateful to him, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't what he did for me. He never got it again. My dad never got it, you know. I don't know why. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous isn't for people that want it or need it. It's for people that get it, you know. I mean, there's so many people that want it, and there's more that need it, you know. But you got to get it. You got to understand this is about turning your life on the back of self-centeredness. And I just think some people have a hard time with that. So I ended up going to the meetings he told me to go to. And I'll tell you what, there was an atmosphere of recovery. My sponsor talks about it all the time. There was an energy in the room that was different from the other places I was going. I don't think there's a bad AA meeting. You know, they're all, if you need a meeting's a meeting. It's just, I believe some are better than others. You know, but there was this energy and there was this atmosphere and people were happy to be sober. You know, the first meeting I went to where he told me to go to, this guy asked me to go to the beach for the weekend. You know, first of all, my first reaction was like, whoa. But after I realized that they were doing stuff sober, they were having fun. You know, these guys were going on ski trips and they were going to the beach and they were doing things sober and they were happy to be alive. They weren't sentenced to church basements, you know. And I ended up going to some of these meetings and I felt pretty good. And I had my ankle bracelet. I ended up getting out of the halfway house and I had a home confinement. And I got home and it should have been the greatest day of my life. I was home and it turned out to be like the loneliest night. I sat there in my house and I had nothing. You really find out who your friends are when you go to prison, right? And I had nobody to call except for the phone numbers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started calling these people. And I started just doing what was asked. You know, I was told to pray on my knees and I prayed on my knees. I went to the meeting and I'll tell you, I was on home confinement, so I could only go. I had 15 minutes before the meeting and I had 15 minutes after the meeting because if I'd not, I get home and this alarm goes off and things go crazy and I go back to jail. So I wasn't hanging out. I wasn't doing a lot of and I didn't have service. And I got off home confinement a year later. It was in October. But in December, I still hadn't changed anything. I hadn't gotten any service, and I was still just going to the meeting, coming home. And I went to one of those AA dances. Those great AA dances. It was horrible. And it was like the worst experience of my life. And I called my sponsor. I brought an ex-girlfriend into the program thinking that we would get sober and live happily ever after. And she ended up finding somebody else within the first 30 days and is now living happily ever after with him. And I'm happy for her. But I called my sponsor and I'm like, I'm done. I'm out of here. I can't take this. This sucks. And I quit. And he said on the phone, he's like, you have no faith. And I said, how dare you? I found God in prison. And he just, you know what he meant was that I didn't have faith. Really what it came down to is I didn't have faith that what you guys were doing was going to work for me. I wasn't doing anything you were doing. I didn't do a thing. So I got 3 service positions in 10 days. I ended up driving around, and I'm going to try to describe this to you. I worked here, let's say, I worked in a spot. I drove in D.C. traffic. Which is about, it was 12 miles, but it took me 45 to 50 minutes every morning to the north. Then I would drive back past my house at 15 to 20 minutes to pick up another guy after work. Then drive south another 30 minutes to pick up another guy. And drive east to pick up another guy. And then we would drive all the way back into D.C. to go to a meeting. I mean, so I was driving, and then by the time, and I took them all home. By the time I got home, it was 11:30 at night. And I would talk to these guys. I mean, by the time I was done, I was too tired. I went home and I went to bed. I didn't have time to think about drinking. I didn't even want to think about drinking. These guys all were my sponsor's friends. They had more time than me. And they listened. And they shared their experience with me. And I was lucky, I think, because I didn't end up with crazy new guys. I mean, I love crazy new guys. Don't get me wrong. They're awesome. They're fun to be around. But for me, I was lucky that I ended up with some guys with some time that were able to listen to me and share their experience. And I wasn't getting sicker about getting better, you know. And I got those services and things changed. My life took off, man. Everything got great. My relationship in AA got better and things were awesome. I mean, so much so that, I mean, my home group, people in my home group were calling me the happy Hindu, you know. And it was fun, man. Life was great. And I caught the service bug and I haven't let go of it. I love doing service, whether it's area level, group level. I've had the opportunity to chair a couple AA conferences, a young people's conference in Maryland, and a big committee for the International Conference of Young People in AA. And I do area. I'm the chairman of our area intergroup, and I'm lucky and I'm humbled to be able to give service. And so I think personally, for me, that service is spiritual. When I do something for you without asking anything in return, something changes in me. You know, and I set up a meeting. When I set up a meeting, I'm not a very anal retentive person at all. I'm kind of not very organized. But when I get to that meeting and I set up these chairs, I make sure they're all in a straight line. You know what I mean? And I make sure they're there because I don't. When that guy walks in and his life is chaos, when he walks through that door, I don't want the in here to be chaos. This is some place where it's safe. You know. And I really believe service is a spiritual thing. I got to tell you, then you know, everything was great for so long, and then about 3.5 years sober, my life changed. Life happened. Life really just happened. My mom was going blind in one eye. The girl thought I was going to marry, my AA girlfriend was going to. She broke up with me. The business that I had started 5 years later now was bankrupt. I had less money than I had when I was 15 years old and started working. I had a mortgage and all this stuff, and I mean, I had no idea. I mean, it's all outside things, but it was all these things that needed to take care of. You know, I ended up, my friend had offered me to go work in a gas station. He owns a gas station. And I'm going to preface this with, there's no bad way to make a good living. There's absolutely no way. No bad way to make a good living. Whatever you do, you do. We're all God's kids. And it took me a hard lesson to figure that out. I went to go work in the gas station, and then he showed me part of my responsibilities was to clean this public bathroom. I lost it. My ego had gotten so big in Alcoholics Anonymous that I thought I was above that. I mean, it killed me. I mean, along with all the other emotional stuff that was going on, it just killed me. And I ended up doing it. And what happened was I forgot that 2 years before that I was in prison cleaning bathrooms for free. You know, that's how far things had gotten so good that I'd forgotten where I came from. And I was in that bathroom the next day on my knees crying because I was in more emotional pain than I've ever been in, drunk or sober. And then a guy from AA called me. You know, it was the first time in 3 years that I wanted to take a drink. And he ended up calling me while I mean, thank God I cleaned the bathroom floor, right? I'm on the knees in there. But he called me, and he talked to me, and I got out of that bathroom, and hour or two later, a guy I used to sponsor just got out of rehab and called me and asked me to, you know, sponsor him again. And I took him down. 2 days later, I took him down to Sessions by the Sea, a 3,000-person AA conference down in Ocean City in Maryland. And I'll tell you, I didn't want to be there. I hated it. But I was still chairing this conference. We had a dance to do that. On Saturday night of that conference, we were sponsoring a dance. And I didn't want to be there, and I hated every minute of it. But I had to be there because of him. And I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous that it's not how I feel, it's what I do. Because I was miserable. I was absolutely miserable. And it took me a while to get out of it. But I was still showing up for them. And that guy didn't stay sober, you know, but I did. And sometimes that's just how it works. It's because I did what I was supposed to do. And everything got better, you know, like it does. If you stay here and do what you're supposed to do, it gets better. And I was down with my sponsor. We did a little pigeon family retreat, and I'm sitting next to him on the couch, and I got to ask you a question because I feel pretty good right now. I said, how do I know where my reliance lies? He's like, what do you mean? I said, well, when everything was really bad, I felt really bad. And now I got all this stuff. You know, I got the job back. Me and the girlfriend got back together. I got a job. I have money, and everything's going okay. I said, well, what are you doing differently? And I said, nothing. I said, you know, at the time everything was going wrong, I was sponsoring guys, I was talking to him, I was praying, I was reading the book, I was going to meetings, and I was still doing that stuff when it got better. And he said, well, there you have it. And I said, huh? and really, I mean, that's it. If, as long as I do what I'm supposed to do, it's going to be okay. You know, and to me, that's the essence of the third step. As long as I do the next right thing and I take the action, whatever the outcome is whatever it's supposed to be. And it's then, you know, sometimes it's going to work out for me, and sometimes it's going to work out against me, but it's going to work out, you know? And really, that's the bottom line. And that's me having faith in a higher power, and that's me understanding that there's a God, and just turning my will and my life over to Him. And that's giving it to Him, and whatever the results are, I got to be okay with, as long as I take the right action. If I don't take the right action, the only person I have to blame is me. A little while later, about 5 years sober, or... No, I guess it was about a year after that. I ended up applying for a job. And I didn't know it was at a law firm. So I applied for this job. And things are going well in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm I'm seeing changes, and I'm feeling changes, and I feel like a different person. And I'm living with my mom, who I've lived with since I got sober, or since I got out of prison. And me and her are doing well, and my sister and I are actually, I went to see her, and me and my mom went out to San Francisco to see her. And it was for Christmas, and we were out there, and we were sitting there, and right when I was getting ready to leave, my sister looked over at me and my mom and said, "I think this is the best Christmas we've ever had." And it was, you know, there was no arguing, there was no anything. We were in her one-bedroom studio apartment, the three of us, for 7 days. 7 days, the three of us, in this thing that was, I swear, it was 12 by 12, with a kitchen. But we didn't argue, and we didn't do anything, and we were together. And I live with my mom, like I said, and I take care of her, and I do the best I can. And it's not Leaver to Beaver all the time, you know. I lose it sometimes, but I apologize immediately, because I can't live like that anymore. But I applied for this job, and I ended up going there, and I went through the process. I filled out the application. I marked yes to the question of, have you ever been convicted? And I went through the process, and they called me, like, a week later after I've interviewed with, like, six people already. And they're like, "Well, we noticed you answered yes to the question." Like, yeah, I was wondering if you were going to get to that. And they wanted to know what happened, and I told them. And then they wanted to do a background check. I was like, "Go ahead, I just told you everything." Then they did the background check, and then they wanted me to meet with the two chief administrative officers of this law firm, the chief HR lady and the chief business development person, or whoever they were, chief of marketing, who I was going to work for. And I go in there, and we start talking, and they're like, they said, "You know, this is a drug-free workplace. How can you assure us it's going to stay that way?" And I said, "Well, I haven't taken a drink or a drug in 3.5 years, and I don't plan to ever again." They're like, "Okay." Another 5 minutes of questioning, and then I left. And 20 minutes later, they offered me the job. Now, I'm in this job. 6 months after I'm there, we move. We move to a building that is directly across the street from the building I worked in when I got arrested. So, 5 years later, I'm doing almost the exact same thing, in almost the exact same place, making almost the exact same money. Completely different person. And I don't know how you get from where I was to where I was that day without a higher power and with a God. And it wasn't by any doing of my own. It was by doing what was asked of me in Alcoholics Anonymous and talking to a sponsor and praying and doing what I was supposed to do. About last year, I was sharing this conference that I was telling you about. And it had been a 2-year process. We bid on it for the first year. We didn't get it. A year later, we bid. So it was 2 years of, like, doing stuff in AA. You know, we're throwing parties. We're doing hotel kind. We're doing all this stuff so we can have this conference. And my mom goes out to see my sister for vacation. And the conference is going on. Saturday morning, I get a call. It's 9 a.m. with a 9 a.m. meeting at our conference. And it's my sister from California. So it's 6 a.m. there. And I knew something was wrong. My mom had deteriorated. My mom was sick, a little sick before this. We never thought it was as bad as it was. And she called, and my sister, my mom couldn't talk, and she was delirious, and her kidneys had failed. And my sister didn't know what to do, and she was crying, and she's like, "What do I do?" I was like, "Take her to the hospital, and we'll go from there." And I spent this day, and this roller coaster of a day of not knowing if the conference was going to break even. You know, I'm getting information, like, we're trying to see if this is going to, I'm getting information from my mom, getting good results, we're going to break even, we're going to be okay, and my mom's getting sick. I'm back and forth and back and forth, and I got swept up, because if it wasn't for that conference, it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, the loving arms of Alcoholics Anonymous surrounded me that day. I had a best area delegate who was speaking there, asked me what was wrong. I told her, and the first thing out of her mouth was, "Let me know what you need me to do, I have 2 kidneys. She told me that, and then she sent me an email a week later, said, "What do I need to do to get tested?" It wasn't just something that came out of her mouth. I realized that day, I had lived with my mom, I told you, I had no idea what to do, but at that moment, she had her own God, and I had mine, and there was nothing else I could do, and I had to accept what was going on, and I couldn't do anything, I just had to be, and like I said, Alcoholics Anonymous took care of me. My mom, when she got coherent enough to talk, and I was talking to her about a week later, 10 minutes into the conversation, she asked me how my sponsor and my grand sponsor were doing. My house is an AA house. You know, I live with her, and she knows the names of my sponsees. She knows the name of my sponsor and my grand sponsor, and we have barbecues, and we have pigeon meetings at my house, and she comes down, and she makes her presence known, you know, and it's a great thing, and my guys love her, and they take care of her. I had a 7-time convicted felon. One of the convictions was attempted murder. Bring her dinner and sit and talk to her. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for me, you know. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous seeking a God. I didn't know I wanted to find a God. I didn't know I wanted to be sober. But I know there's a God in my life. I'm going to tell them. I was talking to Billy about something. Billy, when he called me to ask me to speak, I was going through a rough time. A lot of you guys knew Ashley, who came up here and spoke a few months ago with my girlfriend, and we had broken up. And a lot of it was my doing. I found out. But what had happened was I got confused about what God-given instinct was, and I had asked this guy, I got confused about what I felt. And I had asked the guy who was a lot of times sober, I was like, you know, I'm looking at one thing and I think it's God-given instinct. Can I get rid of this, or is it learned, you know, what is it? And he said, well, and it was the way I was looking at her, and I was making her feel unwanted, you know, and he said, well, doesn't society teach us, this is a good-looking woman, and this is a handsome man, this is whatever, you know, and I was like, yeah, I agree with that. And he said, well, if that's a learned behavior, can it be changed? And I felt like I got kicked in the stomach, because I realized what I had done. So he asked me to, you know, if it's so, you know, as you go forward, ask God to, you know, when you pray, if it's His will for you to be in another relationship, to see it through His eyes and not your own, through His perception and not your own, and pray for discernment for the right time to maybe apologize. I hadn't talked to Ashley in 3 weeks, and she called me a half hour after I hit my knees and prayed in my office that day. And I was able to apologize for doing what I had done. There's a God. You know, there's a higher power. There's something working. The fact that we can sit in this room tonight as alcoholics and not want to take a drink and be here is proof positive to me. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life that I never, ever thought that I would be able to have. I mean, I told you about getting kicked out of school and all that stuff. I'm in grad school. I'm getting straight A's. How that works. You know, but I mean, really, and it's not, it's about, because I do the things that task me of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I came to you a lying, cheating, stealing, drug-dealing alcoholic, selfish and self-centered to the extreme. And on most days, I can tell you that I'm just an alcoholic. Which is, you know, and my mom, you know, and all the gifts and all the stuff that I get in Alcoholics Anonymous, none of it compares to the peace of mind that my mom gets. You know, nothing that I do in Alcoholics Anonymous will repay just that. I can never repay that. If you're here and you're not happy, joyous, and free, find somebody that is. You know, jump in their back pocket and do what they're doing. The book promises happy, joyous, and free. If it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. That to me is the closest you get to a guarantee in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do what's asked of you, and you will get what we promise. And I've seen it. You know, so. I thank you guys for my life. I thank you for letting me share, and I thank you for letting me be here.